Good afternoon. It's another beautiful day in Anchorage for Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Woolforth, and today we're going to try to take a slightly more upbeat view on the economy than you're used to. Well, how do you have an upbeat conversation when you're way, way down in a hole? Well, there's nowhere to go and up, right? We're going to be talking about where the economy is now, where we expect it to go. We'll have some of those hard numbers, and we're going to be realistic about that. And we're also going to talk about what are the hopes for the future. What could it be like after this recession is over? How could we get there? And the folks who are talking about that. So that's our topic today on Hometown Alaska. And please stick with us for the next hour as we get into this and contribute your thoughts. We'd love to hear about your economic ideas. How could Anchorage and Alaska come out of the doldrums? And how is this recession affecting you? And what are your thoughts? I'll be giving out the phone number to get on the show in just a minute, so get your pencil. But first, I want to introduce my guest. Rick Goodfellow is the owner of KLEF Radio, the classical radio station in town. He's also the impresario of the ghost tour of Anchorage, and he's turned into an economic development person, too, with a conference he's putting on. Thanks for being here, Rick.
Oh, thank you, Charles. Honored to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. And Muhsin Ghoutabi is here, kind of a regular guest, because I think he explains the economy as well as anyone I've ever talked to. He's with the Institute for Social and Economic Research, and he's an economist. Thanks for being here, Muhsin.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you did some projections about what was going to happen in this recession, and it sounds like your projections have pretty much been coming true so far. So as you look at the whole of the recession as like one big dip, where are we in that dip? Are we halfway down, three quarters of the way, or just starting out?
Yeah, we're in the middle of the second year. Last year, we projected that we would lose about 2% of jobs. We ended up losing about 1.8% of wage and salary jobs. That obviously does not take into account any self-employment. Those jobs last year were fairly contained in those sectors that were initially hit, oil and gas, construction, and obviously state government spending. And then we saw some very significant losses in professional and business services. Think about it as the consultant sector.
And these would be people providing services to the sectors, oil and gas and state government, that lost all the jobs.
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. So those are basically, if you want to think about them as that first wave of support sectors that are most connected to oil and gas, and they're very high-paid jobs as well. Mm-hmm. In this second year in which we're in right now, 2017, the recession has spread across the rest of the economy, and so we're seeing losses in retail, we're seeing losses in accommodation and food services. Those are sectors that I think of as household spending dependent sectors, right? And so as people start feeling the squeeze, they start scaling back on their purchases, and so we're seeing that happen. However, we're still seeing some bleeding in those originally hit sectors. And state government, obviously, is also still shedding jobs. Federal government has held steady. When you compare it, for example, to 2014, we're at about the same level. The surprising sector is local government that's actually grown a little bit. And that does not seem like it's sustainable, right? And right. So when you ask, getting back, circling back to your question, where are we? We're probably in the second year, the second big year of job losses. That's not to say that we're going to revert to normal, barring any significant cuts or any major taxes. Mm-hmm. The losses in 2018, 2019 should not be as large as what we've experienced in 16 and what we're going to be experiencing in 17.
All right. So we're maybe partway there. The suffering may be, the band-aid may be halfway off. Rick, I want you to talk about your conference and your work in economic development in a minute. But right now, I want you to talk as a businessman. Mm. You run a radio station.
Yeah, radio station.
You sell ads, right?
I try.
So you're dependent on the business community and the economic.
I sure am.
How has that felt for you? And when you talk to your clients, what are they talking about?
Oh, there's definite contraction. Definite contraction in the economy. And Muhsin is really the expert here, but I would say half, at least, of economics is people's mental state,
right.
And it tends to be self-fulfilling. And if people are scared, they tend not to spend. And if other people aren't spending, you aren't making as much money, and the whole thing builds one to the other.
Right. Well, it's natural, I think, for anyone, you as a business owner, to think, if everybody else is cutting back, I better not add, right? I better be cautious. Maybe I should cut back.
Look, I have cut back.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. I have.
In terms of your spending at the station?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what does that look like for you? I mean, does it make it harder for you to do your work, or what are the impacts of that?
Well, in some ways, I indulge myself less. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I'm a pretty self-indulgent guy. I don't do a classical music radio station
to make
big bucks. You know? But yeah, I don't spend as much on things that I could do myself. And, you know, if I don't spend as much, that's cutting into somebody else's paycheck.
Right, right. And so that's how this all comes down to real people out there. And we know that you as listeners are experiencing this recession too. We'd love to hear about your experiences and your thoughts. And then we're also going to talk about maybe some of the hopeful, maybe some of the light at the end of the tunnel stuff as well. So you can join us by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. That's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And that's a great way to get on the show. I'll see your emails right here in the studio and read them to my guests. So, Muhsin Gotabi from ICER, let's go back to like the cause of this. Oil prices went down a lot, and probably it took a huge amount of money out of the economy and caused reductions at the state government and the university, and also with oil companies themselves and their contractors. That is over though, right? So why do we have to continue suffering? You know, if the money's gone, why are we still going through a recession?
Yeah, the easiest explanation is one that actually Rick has already alluded to, which is the fact that when one person or one sector cuts, especially if it's very deeply connected to the rest of the sectors, then they're going to feel that squeeze as well. And so when you have, so last time oil prices were over $100 was August of 2014, right? And so think about that decline as having affected the two channels that matter, oil and gas, and then state government. There were a lot of projects that were already underway.
Sort of inertia. So there were
projects that were underway, and then there is a significant lag between appropriation of dollars and when dollars actually hit the street, right? And so we had some very significant capital spending budgets in 11, 12, 13 that were still making their way through the economy. And so there was a lag between when these budget reductions happened and when oil prices dropped, and then when we saw the actual economic effects, right? And so when you see the big year of revenue declines, that was a full year before we saw any economic contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, as Rick alluded to, now we're entering a period where obviously the losses in those main sectors, given that they're high paying, given that they're connected to a lot of the rest of the economy, as people are losing their jobs, as their wages are being cut, they're cutting spending, which is affecting your favorite restaurant and affecting the retailer. And that obviously is going to keep going. The other thing that we don't talk about.
We're passing all this money around from person
absolutely.
To person.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's the most overused term in economics, which is the multiplier. But that's essentially what we're observing, right? And so when a dollar gets spent, that dollar helps the person that owns the theater, who employs your neighbor, and your neighbor shops at your favorite retailer.
Right,
and
right,
so,
right.
So we're seeing all of this play out. But there is quite a bit of uncertainty as to how we move forward, right? And so
from the state government, and if they cut their spending by all the money that they don't have, then we'd have another big hit. Right?
So there is that, and then there is the fact that it seems inevitable that new revenues are needed. However, we haven't decided where those new revenues are coming from, which means that a lot of different parties are worried about being the one that will be taxed, right? And so if you're a business and you don't know whether or not your corporate income tax is going to change, you're holding back. And if you're an individual and you don't know whether your income tax is going to be affected, you're potentially holding
back. This is the uncertainty factor Rick was talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that matter, it's difficult to quantify, but that does not mean that it's not real and it doesn't have consequences, because people are sitting on the sidelines. They're not hiring. They're not spending. And during a recession, what you typically want is for people to go out and spend, or if you had resources, for government to dump money into the economy, right? Government is contracting now. Households are sitting on the sidelines. And so that potentially exacerbates things and lengthens this decline.
Right. Rick, do you hear that in your conversation?
Oh, sure. And if I could ask this expert.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have this my own little crackpot theory. That one of the worst things that's happening in terms of attitude, I'm not saying it's bad policy. It's probably the policy I'd adopt if I was the czar of the state. But the whole idea that the state is deliberately spending a lot of money in deficit to run through savings. Well, everyone knows savings are large, but they aren't infinite. It's this sort of demolition derby of how long.
So you're waiting for the other end.
How much will the state soften this recession, and for how long? And that, curiously enough, exacerbates uncertainty. Because, as you said, we're not living in a terrible recession right now, as recessions go. But that's in part because it's being softened by deliberate state deficit spending.
Right. Yeah. True, right?
It's a decision that they needed to make, right? And so... The counterfactual is difficult, meaning how bad would things be right now if they had allowed the budget to be at the $2 billion that we get in revenues. Mm-hmm. When we did our estimates, you know, those numbers are scary. I don't know that they're realistic, but when we basically said what would happen if you tried to close the budget all at once, then that means 30,000 jobs would disappear from the economy immediately, right? And so that doesn't seem like the right thing to do, because once you have that much of a shock, then I don't know whether something structural happens and the floodgates open, right? And so,
But also, let's remember that we've lost this oil revenue.
Yep.
But we also have this revenue that comes from our investments in the permanent fund that we haven't been using for anything. We've paid out a dividend. We put it back into the earnings reserve.
Yeah.
So we still have that revenue that we could use. So we don't really have to cut a $3 billion gap, right? Because we can use significant, maybe 2.5 out of that fund.
Yeah.
You know. So I think this is one of the things that has caused a lot of anxiety, the repetition of the $3.5 billion figure, because that's really not the figure.
Yeah, and if I may, one of the things that I think is important is that if we have this conversation in segments, the state government issue, as you correctly point out, is probably not a $3 billion problem, right? And so because we can sustainably get from, if we do agree to use resources from the permanent fund, we can get somewhere between 2.5 and 2.9, depending how you do it. Now, that means the state government problem is about a $700 million, $800 million problem. Okay, so let's put that aside for a minute. That means now you've linked your financial asset to state government revenues and you're good. The problem is oil and gas was affecting both state government and the private sector, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a huge boost for the private sector. And I don't like to separate private from public sector, but for the sake of the conversation, let's. So oil and gas has contracted. You've solved the state government problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the economy problem.
Which is the real economy, yeah.
Which is the real economy. And your financial asset, i.e. the permanent fund, does not directly affect economic well-being.
Right, right.
And so that's where I'm curious to hear about Rick's ideas about how do we now replace this boost that oil and gas was providing. Not that oil and gas is disappearing, but it's arguably going to play a much smaller role in private economic activity going forward.
And that is the very next thing we're going to do. But first, I want to tell people that it is Hometown Alaska. We are talking about the economy with Muhsin Ghotabi from the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska, and Rick Goodfellow, who is the owner of classical radio station KLEF. And I want to talk about Rick's conferences coming up. But first, We have a caller question that I just thought I'd throw out here because it's really right on what we were talking about, saying, are people holding back on purchasing or is spending just going to the web? In other words, we know that nationally retail is going down because people are using the Amazon and other internet sales. And whenever you do that, this dollar that we were handing around in the community is now leaving the community completely. And this leakage is a big issue. And I'm sure, I think you're certainly aware of that,
Rick. Oh, yes, I've noticed that.
Mm-hmm. Is that, how big of a factor do you think that is, Maseen?
Purchasing behavior has moved towards the internet. Now, is there reason to believe that the recession is exacerbating online purchasing? I'm not sure.
I think the person is saying that actually that maybe that the online purchasing is exacerbating the recession.
Yeah, maybe.
Could be.
Yeah,
because every time money leaves Alaska, it
absolutely.
Hurts.
Yeah. And so that's always been true, right? And so clearly, if we had more of that money staying in state, we would potentially be feeling less of this squeeze.
But ICER used to say that a state operating dollar actually generated about $1.2 in the economy. And that always sounded low to me, but that's what ICER used to say.
It's about 1.5 or so. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That sounds more plausible to me. Yeah. But clearly, it generated more than just that $1 going into one bank account one time. But then what happens to that dollar? You know, why go to the bookstore down the street? I'll just go to Amazon.
Uh-huh.
That dollar doesn't circulate in Alaska nearly as long as it would have otherwise.
Yeah. And I forgot to give out the phone numbers, and then we're going to get to Rick's conference. The phone number here, if you want to get on the show with my guests, is 550-8433, 550-8433. Anything you want to say about the economy. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. All right, Rick, you decided to do something about this.
Well, I'm trying. You're giving me too much credit, like I've got some sort of master plan. I really don't. But I'm fascinated by the whole Alaska question. I mean, mm-hmm. I've lived here all my life, like you, a lot of similar experiences with you. I'm just fascinated by it. I mean, what's more interesting than the place I live, after all, and my economic future? Very important. And the more I studied it, the more I realized, boy, this is difficult. This is really, really difficult. And so I said, maybe I should gather people a lot smarter than me and get them all together and get them to talk, and maybe I can eavesdrop on the whole thing and listen. Mm-hmm. It's not like this is step one in the Rick Goodfellow conquers the economic challenges problem. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
I thought you had it covered.
No. Wish it was.
So you're putting together this conference, but I have the sense that it's more of a positive look at things, right? I mean, you've got some amazing entrepreneurs who are coming in who are actually making things happen.
Yeah, some of them. One of the panels, the subtitle is People Who Are Doing Surprising Things and Doing Surprisingly Well While They Do It.
Uh-huh.
The economy is an interesting thing in that when some people are doing terribly, when most people are doing terribly, somebody somewhere is doing very, very well. You know, economics is cold. It doesn't really care. Dollars just go where they go. Mm-hmm. And once you get over that you shouldn't take it personally, you say, what can I do and what do I want to do? Do I want to get personally rich? Do I want to try and build a better Alaska economy? And those things often get conflated. I tend to think in terms of what can we do to build a community economy in Alaska. I don't want to get all left-wingy on you, but, you know, that's the place that I've spent my whole life. But when you really look at the most efficient use of dollars, Alaska has some real, real disadvantages. And one of the things I hope to accomplish is get a clearer view on where does Alaska have an unexploited comparative advantage over the rest of the world? That's not a seldom asked question, I regret to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been a resource exporter. That's really all we've been.
Mm-hmm.
And more people are talking about, well, could we innovate our way out of this? In other words, we could come up with new business ideas. I wrote about one that is in this morning's newspaper about some ladies who are trying to start a shoe company.
And I saw those very ladies present just earlier this morning.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. And so is that some of sort of what you're thinking about?
Well, I'm interested in hearing from anybody and everybody. And some such folks are going to be presenting at the panel. But nothing's going to replace oil.
Right.
You know, and everyone said that at the time when Prudhoe was announced, and it'll change Alaska forever. And I was a kid, and I said, yeah, yeah, sure. And, well, what, 2017? Who cares? It's unimaginably far away. What? Here we are. And a whole lot of money has flown through Alaska, and yet we seem to have pretty much a colonial sort of.
Yeah, we've as they say, the resource curse, which I want to talk about more, which is that when you're getting all this free money from a resource, why do anything else? There's no reason to innovate. There's no reason to do anything but spend the money.
But it's always been that way in Alaska. At the time,
from the beginning.
Well, it is Alaska Day, after all. The transfer of Russia,
1867,
turning over Alaska to the United States, and those who opposed it in the United States, the New York World, which hated President Andrew Johnson, if he was for it, they were against it, and vice versa. They called Alaska a sucked orange. But you know, once all the furs were gone.
Nothing left.
Well, there's no wealth there. What do we bother with? Well, in a way, you might want to view exploited oil fields as a sucked orange. Now, I'm not there, but I'm saying there's a reasonable case
that could be made. Nothing else will ever happen again.
You know, we took the easy oil, and it's expensive oil. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get back to it one day. That sort of view. I don't take that view, but I can see people making a plausible case that way. Yet, in that sucked orange, Uncle Sam, on the whole, did pretty well over the years. But, gosh, in 1867, I don't think anybody was talking about oil. Whale oil? What do you mean?
Yeah. And
where?
Right.
Prudhoe
right.
Bay. Where is Prudhoe Bay?
There'll be something new. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up 150 years of Alaska history being marked today, you know, since this Treaty of Session. I want to quickly go to a caller who has been waiting. Ellen from Anchorage, did you have a question?
Well, it's mostly a statement in regards to the comment about dollars going out of state and the people choosing to buy things, for example, on Amazon. So I just had a recent experience. I wanted to buy a cookbook, for example. I go to Barnes & Noble's, and I look at the price that they charge, and I look at what Amazon charges, and there's a huge difference, and Amazon is a lot cheaper, and they'll deliver it to me for free, so essentially for free. So, and it's not just with books and bookstores. It's with things like healthcare and people choosing to go out of state for healthcare because of our incredible, obnoxiously high prices that don't seem to be justified. So it's just a comment, not really a question. That I think there's reasons for our behaviors, and I'm not an economist, and you are. And
I think it's a really good point, Ellen.
Yeah,
I think it's a great point because one of the things that's happened, and Rick was talking about Alaska history, is that when transportation and communication were more difficult, Alaskan businesses didn't have to compete with businesses outside Alaska as much. We used to have like little family-owned clothing stores and every kind of store and then we got big chains that came up here mostly in the 90s, drove a lot of those businesses out, and now we've got the internet sort of making the next stage. But each of these, Musin, is forcing our businesses to compete with the rest of the country. But we still do have some inherently higher prices. So how does that work out? I mean, have you thought about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the, I don't want to say the great puzzles, but the stickiness of this premium that the caller was referencing.
Why are the prices higher?
Yeah. Why are they so much higher, right? And so I always tell this little anecdote. I think it was my first year here. I was up late at night. There was a commercial for Pizza Hut that said a large for $10.99. And out of curiosity, I went on my computer and I typed 99507. And then I get $20 for the exact same thing, right? And so, and I'm sure that every single person has, you know, had an anecdote like that. Now, the interesting thing about what we're discussing is, will consumers turn even more to the internet as they become more conscious of their spending when these premiums, you know, are so high? And so They differ, as you know, from sector to sector. You and I have had many a conversation about healthcare. Obviously, it's the most prominent one. As we're having a conversation about sales taxes, those decisions potentially become even more relevant because that gap now grows even more than it currently is if a sales tax were to be implemented. So there is really no easy answer, right? And so we believe in market forces. We believe in, you know, allowing businesses to set prices and that people are going to respond to, you know, what's available.
But if the local businesses say, we're now going to match the internet, then they have to, that's a downward pressure on their wages, right? And so that potentially lowers the quality of life for people living in Alaska.
Yeah. No, I mean it's a vicious cycle, right? And so whenever we talk about these price differences, my mind always goes to, well, what's the solution? You can't just impose a price, right? And so, because as you correctly point out, there are workers that gain wages from that job and they'll be affected and they'll have a hard time paying their rents and then the landlord will have issues. And so, unfortunately, it's one of those unsatisfactory answers because there are a lot of things at play.
Yeah. Rick, did you want to?
I've got a little dog and pony show that I've done a few times, Rotary clubs and that sort of thing. One of the slides says globalization works against us, which alludes to exactly what you're saying. It once upon a time when you couldn't get milk here fast enough so it wouldn't spoil, there was a very considerable dairy industry.
Right.
Those days are gone. And the thing that it took me a while to get used to this, but the world really doesn't need Anchorage, Alaska. Anchorage, Alaska has to find a way to show the world why it's necessary.
We need a function, right?
Get over it. That's just the way it is.
Right.
And a lot of us just aren't there yet.
I think, you know, the globalization issue is an interesting one because, again, talking about these women with their Pandeer shoe company, they wouldn't be able to do what they're doing without globalization. They've
Absolutely.
Got somebody outside designing the shoes. They've got people prototyping the shoes in Asia and in Mexico. And in fact, they were talking about, well, if the TPP had passed, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we could have manufactured them even more cheaply in Asia, and then that money would have been coming back here. So in a way, it's like globalization makes it harder, but it also creates opportunities, right?
It does. But here's something that often gets conflated when we talk about innovation. And I've got to credit a brilliant guy from Alaska Open Wire, Eric McCallum.
Mm-hmm.
And he just nailed it once. And to him, it was, of course. But to me, it was, oh, yeah. But he said, we don't need world beater ideas. Because if you invent a better widget that everybody in the world has to have, it will not help the Alaska economy very much because in order to manufacture that widget, you can't afford to make it here or someone Right. else will rip you off and make it somewhere cheaper.
Right.
What we need are ideas. If your concern is building an Alaska economy, if that's your concern, then we don't need world beater ideas. We need things that somehow enrich each other.
I wonder about that, though, and because we... Our costs are higher, has been mentioned. We're really far away from everything. It seems like manufacturing stuff is hard. In fact, even selling resources, unless they're high-value resources, we haven't been able to do. We haven't been, you know, coal is not being exported from Alaska anymore, for example. But these innovators, like, if it really is a knowledge economy, and I'll turn to you on this, Musin, and maybe this is an avenue towards economic development, maybe it's not, but if they come up with an idea and they manufacture it somewhere else and it's drop-shipped somewhere else, does that help us or not?
Sure. I mean, of course, it helps us from a quality of life standpoint because you do want an economy, you do want a place that has people, that has entrepreneurs, that has people with new ideas. It also helps us if those profits are brought back into the state, right? And so we've all been talking about, for example, the resource industry that generates value from within the state and a considerable portion of that value goes out of state. The imperfect analogy that I would give to the entrepreneur is the native corporations, right? And so in that they've now diversified quite a bit and they're generating a considerable amount of their profits from out of state.
Right.
And those profits are coming back. And obviously that's helping the economy. Obviously that's helping communities. And so I say absolutely that innovation, irrespective of where, you know, the parts are made, will help Alaska. The caveat being, and as we were saying before the show, the leakage issue will still rear its ugly head when these new products or these new ideas come out. Because if you're making something for a dollar and 90 cents of the parts that you use are being bought in Seattle, then only 10 cents of whatever you produce is actually making a dent in Alaska.
Right, right. And or if the whole thing is taking place somewhere else and you just live in Alaska, then yeah. I guess your personal income will help the economy, but maybe not
yeah,
that much.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, we always talk about the supply chain, right? And so and the biggest portion of the leakage is not, you know, the non-resident worker. It's actually the things that the business buys in order to produce whatever it's producing, right? And so the more of that that you buy somewhere else, the less that dollar makes a footprint in the state and therefore, you know, does not have as much of an impact as it could.
All right. Well, we need to take a break. And this is such an interesting conversation. I'm glad we still have a half hour left. And I'm going to welcome our listeners to get in on the conversation. Right after we take a short break, I'll come back with those phone numbers so you can get on the show with us and with my guests, Mohsin Gutabi from ICER and Rook Goodfellow from KLEF. My name is Charles Wolforth. Stick with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
Hi, I'm Beth Rose. I think of Alaska Public Media as part of my community. I find that I am more connected with things that happen in Anchorage, in Alaska, and even the world. There's not a day that goes by that I don't listen to Alaska Public Media, and I am always learning. So it's part of my education. Sometimes I listen to the news and I appreciate the quality, unbiased, in-depth reporting. And I realize that I can always count on Alaska Public Media and the sources that it uses, whether it's NPR or BBC or the Canadian Broadcasting System, to bring me news from around the world that I would not hear otherwise. If you appreciate that, raise your hand, stand up today, and make a difference. Donate at alaskapublic.org or call 550-8484. You'll be doing this for yourself. You'll be doing this for our community. Thank you.
And we're back. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. And we're talking today about the economy. We're in a recession. It's not going to last forever. How do we get out of this thing? What's on the other side? And what can we do that's in any way helpful or positive to bring it to an end? It's been a really, really interesting and lively discussion so far with my two guests, Mohsin Gutabi, who is an economist with ICER, the Institute for Social and Economic Research, Rick Goodfellow, owner of radio station KLEF, who is putting on a conference, the Prosperity Summit, which is taking place tomorrow from 9 to 5. It's the Hotel Captain Cook, and got a really, really interesting list of speakers and an opportunity to think about these issues and find out what other people are up to. We want to hear what you're up to. If you have any ideas about improving the economy, do you have any stories to share about how the recession has affected you or how you think we might get out of it? The phone number here is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we've got a couple of callers and emails, but before we do those, I want to give you a chance, Rick, to talk about the conference and what you hope will come out of it. I mean, what are people going to get from the Prosperity Summit? What are they going to, are you hopeful that people are going to say, I've got an idea?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Look, I mentioned this earlier. I'm a very self-indulgent person. I'm doing this because I want to have a really stimulating, interesting day. Uh-huh. And I've invited people who I think will be stimulating and interesting, and I'm going to listen closely, and I'm going to ask them a lot of questions. Yeah. And anybody else who wants to be there and ask their questions and get any benefit, all the better. But I'm telling you straight up, I'm doing this for me.
Are there opportunities? Do you think there are opportunities that have been overlooked?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if I knew what they were, maybe I'd be doing them. But I was just by coincidence.
But you did take an opportunity. You got a radio station.
Yeah. Look, if there had been no Great Recession of 1985, I wouldn't own a radio station. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have afforded it. Couldn't have afforded it.
So you bought it when the market was low.
Yeah.
And you've run it ever since, so 30 years.
It was a classic case of people who were so discouraged that they wanted to give up the federal license. They just wanted to get out from under it. And, you know, say whatever you want about capitalism. It's got a lot of downsides, but it does have a really built-in mechanism for renewing itself in many ways. And I couldn't own a classical music radio station anywhere. And here I was, and I said, well, I've always thought this could work. And some lovely people who were experienced broadcasters said, we got this license, and we are just too old and too discouraged. Please take it off our hands. Huh.
You know, a lot of fortunes were made from those in that 1980s recession who didn't panic, right? Who saw, oh my gosh, housing has dropped to 10% of what it cost before. I'm going to buy a lot of housing.
It's our very first panel.
And now they own all these mm-hmm. Apartments all over town.
So, the very first panel of the day is made up of people who got even wealthier or got wealthy due to that Great Recession.
Yeah. Here's a business idea that came in from one of our listeners. Wants to know, we're unable to recycle glass used here in Alaska. Is this a possible business opportunity? Maybe, right? I mean, you've got a lot of glass beer bottles. I don't know if anybody... I don't think our panelists know, but maybe go for it, Joy. Maybe you can make something of it.
People have tried it over the years. And, you know, one thing that always gets mentioned, and nobody has ever really exploited it, but empty ships. Ships bring stuff up and go back essentially empty. Backhaul could be very cheap.
Right, right. If you can put something on those ships then that people will buy, that would be great. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Palmer. Mark?
Yeah, good afternoon, and thanks for a good show. Hey, I wanted to mention that, you know, if you look at any economic activity you're thinking of or you want to think of, energy is just fundamental to everything we do, fundamental to our homes, our lives, our businesses, everything. So how we use energy is critical to every other thing we do out there. And the fossil fuel age is coming to an end. We don't know exactly when, but our vulnerability to that is clear right now. So it seems to me that we need to be putting a lot of our energy, our resources, our thought process into the transition from the current system to basically energy efficiency and local renewable energy resources for whatever activity we want to pursue out there. And as mentioned earlier, when you do that, when you start to focus on local and clean energy and energy efficiency first. Those of us in the energy world know that you got to do energy efficiency first. But anyway, when you start to focus on local and clean renewable energy resources, those dollars circulate in the local community. They don't go out to anywhere else. They stay in Alaska. So, you know, if you think of whatever activity we do out there, energy is fundamental to it. It takes energy to do everything we do. So we need to focus on that kind of thing. And that way we can get through this. But we need a transition strategy. And I'll stop there.
Transition strategy to post-oil economy. I think one of the things that we're struggling with, and I want to throw this out to both of my guests, is are we in an oil price slump? Or are we in a, as our caller says, a new technology world where there's going to be less demand for oil? And there's other ways to produce oil elsewhere that are less costly than Alaska, and that's not going to change. Mohsin, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the short answer is when you listen to the experts, and I don't forecast oil, I'm not smart enough to do so, it seems like the days of $100 barrel are behind us. There has been tremendous finds all over the world. Shale gas has changed the game. Production has declined since 88. Again, I'm not a doom and gloom guy, and I don't believe that oil is disappearing tomorrow. But the oil that's left underground is either difficult to get, extraction is costly or is in federal lands. And as we know, there are things that are outside of the state's powers in moving forward with it. So I don't think that there is a better time to start thinking. And I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, by the way, right? And so we don't need to make a decision as to how we think about oil before deciding to pursue these opportunities, to start thinking about comparative advantage, to start thinking about local-driven strategies to retain as much of the value as possible. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't think we can bury our heads in the sand and hope that oil comes back and helps us. Because even if it does, production has declined quite a bit.
Production has declined, and at some point, demand will decline as people move to alternative energy.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to add something to that, Rick?
Just predicting anything is risky. But, you know, it was not that many years ago that UAA Complex Systems brought up a distinguished lecturer with immensely convincing slides and proof that of what they called peak oil. You know, oil was going to be $2,000 a barrel. Like, how could it be any other result? And it was actually pretty convincing. It's been a while since I've heard from any of the peak oil guys. They seem to have gone silent.
Yeah.
But it was a convincing case. It actually was.
We had peak demand rather than peak supply. Thanks for that question, Mark. You know, your comment, Rick, reminds me of the Yogi Berra quote, prediction is difficult, especially about the future.
Yes, right?
Paul is with us from Anchorage. Paul?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
So I had a question about what your guests' thoughts are on the expansion of a road system within the state. Seems like we mentioned transportation earlier. Really, when you look at a map of the state, everything is cut off basically from the Anchorage to Fairbanks corridor. There's nothing running west. Wonder what your guests' thoughts are of expansion of a road system out west, how that would keep money within the state, lower the costs for the bush communities, and maybe do an ecotourism boost.
So you think using roads to supply goods out to communities and then maybe also be something that would help boost tourism. Thoughts on that, Rick?
Mine is, again, it's borrowed from someone who probably prefer not to be credited, but she said, the Alaska business plan is to lose money on every resident and encourage people to move here. The state's broke. Whatever roads we have, maybe they were built advisedly or ill-advisedly, but you're asking an entity that is in deficit spending to spend more.
Yeah.
It won't work. Not until there's some sort of indigenous economy which will be able and willing to pay taxes in return. I know taxes, I don't want to pay them either. But we are living the tail end of this incredible infusion of money, and we spent money maybe wisely, maybe not so wisely, but what we did is what we did. And the party's over. And we've got to clean up the mess.
Right. So, I mean, in a sense, whatever economic development we're going to come up with is going to be idea-based, like what you're talking about, rather than money-based. And frankly, we don't have a real good record with our money-based economic development.
Not so good.
We built a, you know, tried to build a barley economy.
That was milk. One of my favorites. I liked the fish factory, too.
The fish factory, the rocket launch facility.
Oh, yeah, that's worked out real well.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Mustaine, are there examples out there where state governments have effectively spent money on economic development?
Well, I was going to say that the devil's advocate argument would be the barrier to entry for a lot of private business declined over time because of state spending. The road system, even in Anchorage, right? And so has made it much, much easier for the national retailers to enter, right?
Oh,
and
I
so
see. Yeah.
That's not, you know, one specific project improving the welfare of the people, but it's investments in things that would not pencil out for any one particular company.
Infrastructure, essentially.
Infrastructure that, again, lowers this barrier to entry that has made the Alaska economy much, again, I said earlier that I don't like the word diversified, but much more mature because it's made it much easier for certain projects, certain industries to grow, both in the urban areas, in the rural areas. Specifically about the road project, the problem with those is you have to figure out who bears the costs and to whom do the benefits actually accrue when you build a road like that. Meaning, are you opening up a road to a particular rural area that's going to put pressure on subsistence living? Or if there are tourists, is the money that the tourists are bringing in being spent in the communities that are most proximate to that road?
Right. And so also there are maintenance costs.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah. But yeah, I mean, the infrastructure argument can't be put aside when we think about these investments. Yep. And I completely understand that money is scarce right now.
Let me see if Paul is still there. Paul?
I am.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? I mean, about this issue, should we be, you know, paying taxes to build roads and boost the economy? Or how do you feel about what the guest just said?
Well, I tell you, this is just me, my personal opinion. But I don't mind spending a usage fee. I drove before. You had to take a ferry to get to. I was in Canada. You had to take a ferry to get to Prince Edward Island. I always wanted to drive to Prince Edward Island. There's a $40 toll on the bridge to drive back and forth out of Prince Edward Island. There are people driving on that bridge back and forth out of Prince Edward Island. So I think if you were able to build something, and charge people a reasonable usage fee that could take care of your maintenance. I just see countries all over the world, really, when you look at a world map, you see roads, you see communities being linked. And here, not so much. The road system is very sparse. Even when you go to poorer countries, there's at least paths and roads to these villages. And I just don't see that here, and I think that just is driving the cost up. If you had a usage fee for these roads, you know, pay to drive the tunnel into Whittier. You know, there's a precedence for that.
Yep, so I hear you.
Toss that back out.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing, and I think one of the things that this brings up is that during the period when we did have money to burn coming from the North Slope, projects were built not based on their economics, but based on the politics. And a lot of those projects didn't make any sense. Maybe in the new future, where we actually have to pay for things, we'll start basing projects on the economics and the need.
Yeah, maybe we'll be smarter in the future, predictions.
I'm just saying that if we're spending our own money, we might be a little bit more careful than when we're spending free money.
And it's worth mentioning, one person's ridiculous boondoggle is somebody else's hard-earned paycheck.
Right.
And whenever you talk about the government in particular, but for that matter, private industry, any proposal for spending will soon gather a constituency.
Yes, indeed. It's Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. My name is Charles Wolforth. My guests are Rick Goodfellow from KLEF Radio. He is the sponsor of the Prosperity Summit, which is taking place tomorrow in Anchorage. And Musin Gutabi, who is a economist at ICER, the Institute for Social and Economic Research. We have about 12 minutes left. If you want to call in and get on the air with us, the phone number is 550-8433. Email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Let's now go to a caller, Sandy, who's calling from Anchorage. Sandy?
Hey, Charles. This is Sandy Rabinowitz.
Hi.
An idea I've long had, but never been able to get anybody much interested in, is having a statewide network of biological field stations. It's really an idea kind of stolen from the country of Costa Rica, for people familiar with that. Thousands of students go to Costa Rica every year on international exchanges. They live and work at these biological field stations. They're basically housing, food, laboratories sometimes, and classrooms. They're there for 3 or 4 months, and then they rotate out, and new kids from all over the world, particularly the United States, rotate in. It's a small industry, creates jobs for professors, cooks, cleaners, and people, maintenance people that take care of these biological field stations. They tie them to their national parks. We have lots of national parks, we have lots of national wildlife refuges, and we have lots of state parks. It seems like a natural fit to me. It's 12 months a year.
I can
wait offline and or get offline and listen to whatever anyone might have to say.
Yeah, that's just the kind of idea you're talking about, isn't it? Where you are thinking, Rick, about using comparative advantage. In other words, what can we do better than anybody else?
Exactly.
And that's sort of what Sandy is bringing
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
But nobody's done it. Maybe because we haven't had to, or just nobody's had the idea.
Well, some people have done it, but.
There have been eco lodges and that sort of thing. Yeah. But in terms of what his particular idea, I haven't heard it. Mucina, I mean, that's one of the keys to economics, isn't it? Comparative advantage. I mean, figure out what we can do that others can't do. But one of the other things is the theory of efficient markets. Like, if there are great opportunities, somebody would have found them by now. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe not. As you said, have the incentives been right to take advantage of some of these opportunities? Probably not. The other thing is, maybe in some of these places, public-private partnerships are what's needed in order to get some of these projects off the ground. Maybe we haven't actually thought very clearly about local specific areas of strength and how to leverage them, right? And so the state is not, I mean, whenever we talk about the recession, and I make this mistake sometimes, we talk about it as though it's just one homogenous place, and it's clearly not, right? And so different places have different assets that can be leveraged. And maybe the way to start thinking about some of these ideas is to actually do local analysis of the resources that are available, the labor force, and what can we potentially get off the ground in some of these places. Because, I mean, again, you can think about cluster strategies. You can think about, like I said, public-private partnerships. You can think about just strengthening the supply chain, right? And so you can either think about starting something brand new, which is obviously challenging, or get in a new industry, which is next to impossible, or you can think about leveraging or harnessing the resources that are available and ensuring that the support sectors that provide parts for those already existing businesses are actually localized. Right.
So the fishing and marine industry would be an example of this, because so much of that is sourced out of Seattle and Oregon. Yeah. If we could source more of it here, then, you know, it'd be beneficial to the fishermen too, maybe.
Absolutely. That's a really perfect example. Again, that's not to say that this is easy to do, but if you have enough of that resource, you have enough interested parties, and then you have potentially the state behind some of these projects in order to either subsidize them or help with them or put at least parties together, then you can start thinking much more clearly about how much of this value do we get? How much of it gets out of state? And how much of that leakage can we potentially retain in some of these communities, which would help, obviously, right. incomes, jobs, stability. And, you know, it's not going to replace oil, but it certainly improves quality of right. life.
But you've still got to think about beating Astoria, Oregon, or Tacoma, Washington in price, right? Because I believe there was a big ship lift built in Seward. There was a ship repair facility built in Ketchikan, and those all struggled because the price was higher.
Absolutely. But that's the process that we need to go through, is what are the things that we can do better, or that we can at least get close to these other competitors. We're not suggesting having losing businesses, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because you're always going to outsource when there's somebody else that's doing it better. But I genuinely believe, and there is evidence for opportunities to retain more of this money that leaves the state.
Rick, do you think that there's something happening now that makes that more possible than it
yes.
was in the past?
What yes. is it? Desperation.
Okay. Yeah, because before it was always easy to get
That's
a job.
Look, you were a kid, I was a kid. But when Prudhoe Bay came in, one of the sort of assumed, or at least thought out, rhetorics was, oh, this will buy us time. We can build this economy that's always been possible. Well, that was 40 years ago, and here we are. And look, I'm here because of choice. I'm not right. complaining at all. And a lot of the things that happened are wonderful. I've had a great life. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, the easy days are over. And in a way, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. We didn't. That's what they call the resource curse, right? That you didn't have to go out and pursue things because everything came to you. Is that you're nodding, Mucina?
Yeah. No. I mean, you're right. I mean, there is evidence in the literature that resource abundant countries or communities tend to grow slower than they would have had they not had the resource. And so, you know, are you investing less in manufacturing or in education because you now have this easy money, if you will? And so, and there is also evidence that entrepreneurship, self-employment goes up considerably during times of economic declines and contraction. And that's what Rick was talking about, is that either people are laid off or they think about ideas that they had in the back of their heads, like some of the calls that we had, and, you know, they started them up. And so, you know, that's one way of thinking about this contraction is...
Think about it, that, like the glass half full way of thinking about it. Yeah. So here's a question from a listener that came via, I'm not sure if it came via email or phone, but in any of it, the question is, with our rainy day account, I think we're talking about the permanent fund, can we use some of that money to start a dividend to run social services and healthcare? And this is one, this listener, I think, is thinking particularly about those services. But one thing that I think people may not have really picked up on is the permanent fund earns a lot of money every year. And that money will spend in our economy just as well as oil money, right? At Mussin, I mean, that's something that is real, that is going to help us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we do decide to start using earnings from the permanent fund, that can arguably fill somewhere between $2.5 and $2.9 billion of the budget deficit gap. And so as government continues to spend that money, those dollars are going to be no different than oil revenues that government uses, except that the money earned from the permanent fund does not enter the private economy directly. It funds government.
And whatever the government spends it on. If absolutely. It spends it on services from outside Alaska, then
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Rick, did you want to answer that?
It's a formula for keeping the party alive. But this party will run out sooner or later. And some people will be well-positioned and some people won't. And I honestly don't really pass judgment on which is better. I'm just observing things are changing.
Yeah, very much so.
And some people will take advantage of this and some people won't.
Yeah. Do you see an Alaska that is less diverse, less exciting, has less going on 5 years from now, or what do you see?
I fear that, but I hope for much more diverse. I would love to see a lot more little enterprises. Mm-hmm. It won't be oil, but it's almost as though oil never was. And it's like that one trip to Disneyland we fondly remember from our childhood. We lived in an amazing time. It won't be back.
Right.
It won't be back.
Mussin, we only have about 30 seconds left, but when you look 5 years out, what do you see?
Potentially slightly smaller state, but optimistic about the future for sure. I think that there are a lot of opportunities. We have significant amount of savings, and there is no reason to despair.
All right. Well, that's been a great discussion. I learned a lot. I hope you did too. My guest, Mussin Gutabi from ICER, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Rick Goodfellow, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rick is sponsoring the Prosperity Summit. Caller asked, is it free? It is not free. It's $195. You can find out more about that, I assume, from your website.
What an Alaska question. Yeah. Is it free?
It's not free. That's all for today's show. Hometown Alaska's producer is Dave Walden. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.